This morning we begin in 1 Kings chapter 19, even though we're continuing in our look in the book of Romans in Romans chapter 11. But in 1 Kings chapter 19, after an amazing display and demonstration of the power of God, there's a great victory over the prophets of Baal. Amazing demonstration of the power of God, a great victory over the prophets of Baal, which, by the way, those prophets had been made to prosper under Ahab, the king of Israel. And after such a great victory over these 450, and such signs of God being with him, as we would, if you read chapter 18, you'll see all that. Something happens. And we pick up the account at verse 1. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Word comes to Jezebel. And her response is this: Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." And what was Elijah's reaction to that? Verse 3. "Then he was afraid, and he rose, and he ran for his life, and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there." He arose and ran. Now, in 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse 19, Jezebel had a total of 850 false prophets that would dine at her table. That means she provided their support for them. But in this particular challenge, there would be 450 that, again, we note, ate at her table. But after that victory in verse 40 of chapter 18, Elijah said to them, "Seize the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape." And they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook Kishon and slaughtered them there. He took the 450 into custody, and he slew them there at the shore of the brook. How unstoppable he must have felt. How much he must have rejoiced in God's work in him and around him. But then as we begin chapter 19, there's the word that comes to him, or to her, to Jezebel, from her husband. "There will be 450 less at your table tonight." And her response is to send a messenger to Elijah with the promise, an oath, if you will, that by tomorrow at this time, he will be dead. And so Elijah's response is what? He's gripped with fear and he ran. And in this, we cannot help but be amazed. He just stood against 450. And yet he runs at the threat of one wicked woman. How can that be? How can that be possible? Well, we read in James chapter 5 and verse 17 that Elijah was a man. First, he's a man. Though he's a prophet of God, he's a man. And as a man, he is with a nature like ours. A nature like ours. There are, my friends, no superstars. Elijah was a man of flesh. He was not a Marvel comic book character. And this nature further demonstrated itself not just in the instantaneous change of confidence, but it went from bad to worse as he is on the run. Verse 4 of chapter 19, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper, a broom tree, and he asked that he might die, saying, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers." It's enough now, O Lord, take my life. First off, that's not his call to make. And to even to come before God, who at least at this point he acknowledges as the one who gives and takes life, but it is not up to him to say, "Oh God, take my life and do it now." The depths of despair he descends into is alarming. But it's also a common feature of human nature. A common feature of human nature is to picture things as much worse than they really are. That is how a lot of people get elected to office. By painting a picture of things being a whole lot worse than they really are. That is how people sell columns in newspapers every single day. That is how people stay employed by certain cable news networks. By trying to make everything seem to be worse than it actually is. And we live in the midst of a people who are constantly falling for that lie and speaking that way themselves. Overreact to a headline without reading the story. In verse 9, he came to a cave and he lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him and he said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I've been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel forsaking your covenant." I often wonder if he said that with a little whine in his voice. "The people of Israel forsaking your covenant and thrown down your altars and killed your prophets with the sword. And I only am left, and they seek to take my life away. I alone am left. It's just me now, God." And even then, now they seek to take my life away. How could he possibly know? He was the only one left. How could he possibly make that statement before God? "I'm the only one!" Had he been everywhere, all around? Had he been in the southern kingdom as well as the northern kingdom? No, he didn't. He doesn't have all that information. Not only were that, here's the exaggeration and it carries on. "I'm the only one left." And notice what pronoun he uses. "And they seek to kill me." They? Who's the one that gave him the warning? There's one person who has threatened his life. One. But this is the way the old nature in us continues to work. It foments, it makes things to seem so much worse than they actually are. And this propensity is at the heart of what Paul is addressing in Romans chapter 11. It is even to the point where he refers back to this very episode as he is writing to them. So we now turn to Romans chapter 11. We remember that as Paul's writing, much of his writing is anticipating certain objections that people would have. If we look at chapter 10 for just a moment, verse 13, for everyone who calls on the name of the Lord will be saved. How then will they call on Him in whom they have not believed? And how are they to believe in Him of whom they have never heard? And how are they to hear without someone preaching? And how are they to preach unless they are sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news, who bring glad tidings of good things. But they have not all obeyed the gospel, for Isaiah says, Lord, who has believed what he has heard from us? Who has believed our report? So faith comes from hearing, and hearing by the word of God, by the word of Christ. And then he continues, but I ask, have they not heard? Indeed they have, for their voice has gone out to all the earth, and their words to all the ends of the world. But I ask, did Israel not understand? First Moses says, I will make you jealous of those who are not a nation. With a foolish nation I will make you angry. And then Isaiah is so bold as to say, I have been found by those who did not seek me. I have shown myself to those who did not ask for me. But of Israel, he says, and this is, of course, speaking of God, beginning in verse 20. All day long I have held out my hands to a disobedient and contrary people. So what Paul is saying is that God has bypassed much of the unbelieving portion of the Jews. He has gone and taken a remnant from the Gentiles. And so perhaps this makes some wonder, especially when he wrote in verse 12, for there is no distinction between Jew and Greek, for the same Lord is Lord of all, abounding in riches for all who call upon him. And so the objection that he's dealing with here is that there are some who would say, well, then has God rejected? Has he cast away his people? Do we not matter to God anymore? Have we been replaced? And he anticipates the overreaction. Instead of rejoicing that God has brought another group into the people of God, the reply was, what? Is God through with us, the Israelites, the Jews? Is he just going to cast away his people? In Psalm 77, in verse 7, we read, will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Well, Paul's response to this objection is, may it never be. And then he points to the fact, think about something. Who is it that's writing to you right now? Chapter 11, verse 1, I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means, for I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people, whom he foreknew. I'm an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected his people, whom he foreknew. Paul was not the least bit hesitant about speaking of his ethnicity. His presence was living proof that God had not cast off all of Israel. And so in verse 4, here's where he picks up. what we've been talking about. Well, go back to verse 3, or let's finish off verse 2. How he, do you not know what Scripture says of Elijah, how he appeals to God against Israel? Lord, they have killed your prophets. They have demolished your altars. I alone am left, and they seek my life. But what is God's reply to him? I have kept for myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to Baal. Elijah said, I'm the only one left. I alone am left. God says, no. That's not the way it is. There seems to be within mankind a quick mindset of distrust of God. And this really goes to his character, the character of man. Chapter 9 and verse 15. Another anticipation of the arguments that would come his way. Paul says, is there injustice with God? Because immediately, that's what happens. A lot of people get into that point of view. That God can't be just. He can't be really good if he's not doing the things that we expect him to do. The Creator is constantly being judged by the creation. And this goes all the way back to the garden. This is the area that Satan wished to exploit. Chapter 3 and verse 5 of Genesis. For God knows that in the day you eat from it, from that tree, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God. And he doesn't want that. He doesn't want that. He doesn't want you to be like him. He's withholding good things from you because he's not really that good. Well then, where does distrust of God have its root? Who are we aligning with when we question the goodness of God? This whole area of questioning has to be quite bizarre. Think of it for a minute. The objection is, well, has God cast off his people forever? Has he just cast off his people? It would be hard to gather the grace that was necessary to answer that without a level of sarcasm. Because it's really a very foolish question and a very foolish objection. First off, what was Jesus ethnically? A Jew. The 12 apostles. What were they ethnically? Jews. There's not a Gentile in the mix of them. And then on that day of Pentecost, when 3,000 were added onto the church, where were they coming from? They had just been to the temple. They were Jews. And to ask, has God cast off his people? Oh, no, no, no. How silly a statement can that be? The church in Rome that Paul was writing to more than likely was at least 50%, if not more, made up of converted Jews. So just as God replied to Elijah on that day, in verse 4, I have reserved for myself 7,000 who have not bowed the knee to Baal. And you think there's just one? Just one? No, there are 7,000 more. Note, Paul is using Hebrew history to make his point, and then he fast forwards to the present. Verse 5. So too, even so then, at the present time, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. A remnant. A remnant. Now, we would understand that, at least if we're looking at a remnant as far as maybe a piece of cloth or of a carpet, that to be a remnant, it would have to be at least less than 50% of what that cloth was or what that carpet was. He said there's a remnant according to the election of grace. At this present time, there's a remnant chosen by grace. And Paul had touched on this back in chapter 9, particularly verse 11, when he used Jacob and Esau. Now here, there's two children. Two children. One is chosen, the other is not. If you take two and reduce it to one, what percentage do you have? 50%. From the very beginning, as these people are developing, it's never been 100%. Jacob and Esau had the same mother and father. They were the offspring of Abraham, and yet one was chosen, the other wasn't. The same thing when they came out of Egypt. How many it seemed were the people of God. Look at all the Israelites marching out of Egypt, heads held high. Very probably, there's at least 2.4 million people on that march, leaving Egypt that day. But notice what is written in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. First Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. For I want you to know, brothers, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea, and all ate the same spiritual food, and they all drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock which followed them, and that rock was Christ. Nevertheless, notice, with most of them, God was not pleased, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. For most of them, God was not pleased, and they were overthrown in the wilderness, which means most of them, as they paraded out of Egypt that day, really, even though they were ethnically of one group, they were not the people of God. And so he says in verse 6, now these things took place as examples for us, that we might not desire evil as they did. Do not be idolaters, as some of them were. As it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. We must not indulge in sexual immorality as some of them did. And 23,000 fell in one day. 23,000 fell in one day. Turn for a moment to Psalm 95. Psalm 95, verse 6. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord our Maker, for He is our God, and we are the people of His pasture, and the sheep of His hand. Today, if you hear His voice, do not harden your hearts as at Meribah, as on that day at Massa in the wilderness, when your fathers put me to the test. They put me to the proof, though they had seen my work. And for 40 years I loathed that generation and said, they are a people who go astray in their heart, and they have not known my ways. And therefore I swore in my wrath that they shall not enter my rest. I swore in my wrath that they should not enter my rest. Now this is quoted again in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 11. And then in Hebrews chapter 4 and verses 1 through 9, we read basically the same thing. And again, it ends with this: there remains therefore a Sabbath rest for the people of God. But you see, this whole objection that Paul is dealing with comes from an ignorance of history. Though the Jews were commonly referred to and thought of themselves as the people of God, it was never monolithically true. There was never a point in their history where you could look and say, there's 100% of the Jews are following God 100%, and they were 100% of His people. Never been that time. Right from that choice of Jacob and Esau, we're down to 50%. We have thousands upon thousands who die in the wilderness. In fact, on the wilderness of those who left from Egypt and went into the promised land, only two, the rest that went in the promised land were born during the wilderness wanderings. And yet, that grand parade going out of Egypt said, look at all those people, they're people of God. No. God says, with most of them, I was not pleased. Folks, it's never been monolithically true of the Jews that 100% they would all be of the same mind and follow the same thing. And it will never be true of any group, ethnically speaking. But Paul says this: even at the present time, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. A remnant. You see, never in the Word of God has God ever said that I will save 100% of any group. Never did, except, of course, His people will all be saved in the end. But He's never said in the Word of God, I will save every single person of this group, of this ethnic group, or this nationality, of this tongue. Mm-mm. This was true at the time Paul wrote this about the Gentiles as well, because it wasn't 100% of the Gentiles that were coming to Christ either. It's far from any kind of majority of the non-Jewish population that was saved. And again, it will always be, as God has set the pattern, it's all by the grace of God, as He gives us in verse 6. There is a remnant chosen by grace. And if it is by grace, it's no longer on the basis of works. Otherwise, grace would no longer be grace. When God was about to give the promised land, I have turned one more place here, in Deuteronomy chapter 9, Deuteronomy chapter 9, verse 4, as they begin to subdue their enemies, God says to them this: do not say in your heart, after the Lord your God has thrust them out before you, it is because of my righteousness that the Lord has brought me to possess this land. Don't even begin to say that. It is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out before you. Not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart are you going to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of these nations, the Lord your God is driving out from before you, that He may confirm the word that the Lord swore to your fathers and to Abraham. But know therefore that the Lord your God is giving you this good land to possess, not because of your righteousness, for you are a stubborn people. Now, if God were to save 10,000 people, he would be a merciful and gracious God. If he saved 100, if he saved 10, if he saved 1, he would be giving more than people deserved. It's amazingly awful to misread of the purposes of God, to think that he did not wish to save people when he had just added the Gentiles in to the church. He increased the scope. But they were critical because it wasn't their people. But then on top of it all is the incessant preoccupation with numbers. How often is it that every you turn to this page or that page, or you go to this site or that site, and you see someone writing their defeatist drivel about decline? Will there be a church in America in 2050? And every time Pew Research releases a poll that shows any kind of decrease in numbers of Americans who believe. There was one that a couple of weeks ago said, among evangelicals in America, 95% believe that there is a God. Among evangelicals, 95% believe that there is a God. What? What's going on with the other 5? I mean, how would you even begin to fall under the name of a believer if you say, well, you know, there may be many gods. Or there might not be any. And so, you know, that used to be 100%. There's a decline. Oh, mercy. The first thing that we remember then is God knows the numbers better than Pew Research. God knows really who is his. The Lord knows those who are his. You can't get that out of a poll. You really can't even get that out of watching who is and who isn't. The second thing we must remember is God set the numbers from the foundation of the world, from before the foundation of the world. Thirdly, when the Israelites began to go after other gods, God didn't panic. He didn't say, oh, what am I going to do now? My people are just falling for this stuff and leaving by a great number. No, he said, they weren't mine. They start out amongst us, but they left us because they weren't of us. It was his plan. Now, fourthly, do not go away from here thinking that in this message, I don't care about souls or numbers. We do care about souls, and we long to see people saved. And know, as Paul, we read earlier in 2 Corinthians, knowing the fear of God, we persuade men. But never, ever, ever should we ever think that things are not going according to God's plan. No matter what, no matter where, God will always have his remnant. Some days that's a lot more obvious than there is on other days. But God will always have his people. There'll never be a time where he doesn't. And there never has been a time that we can look back and say, he's always had a majority. And boy, wouldn't that make us feel good if we just had a majority? No, you know what needs to be the thing that makes us feel good? Is we have God. We have God. That should be what buoys us and causes the great joy to well up in our hearts, that through Jesus Christ we have the Father. Numbers are his responsibility. Obedience is ours. And even then, he gives us his Spirit and his grace to do that. Let's stand together for prayer.